Hello, everyone, and welcome to the GMS Magazine podcast and YouTube channel. I am Paco Garcia, your host, and this is the Interview Room, the show in which I'm lucky enough to get together with designer friends and ask them a bunch of questions about their game design. This is a bit of a different one, though, because from now on, we're only going to be conducting interviews of crowdfunded projects that are hosted on Game On Tabletop. We're truly sorry, but if you're hosting your project in Kickstarter or any other crowdfunding platform, I would be more than happy to talk to you about it once the campaign is finished. But not meanwhile. Why? Because I think Kickstarter has enough of a market already, and I want to help my friends from Game On Tabletop because they have some absolutely fantastic projects in there. So I would urge and encourage you to please take a look at their platform, either as a primary or secondary crowdfunding platform. There are some more videos of this in the channel, so please do take a look at them. There are some links in the show notes, so you can see what I'm talking about. Anyway, today I have with me Andrew Kornowski. He's written an absolutely mammoth game called Magonomia. It's a fate-based game that started as, you know, a kind of self-project, and it's gone up into becoming a really cool and huge book that is currently being crowdfunded at Game On Tabletop, so please do take a look. What is interesting about this game? Well, you play wizards. You play, you know, magicians. There are several kinds of magicians, and that's all you play. There are no warriors, there are no fighters, there are no clerics, there are no bards. You play wizards in a kind of Renaissance sort of era, which makes it very interesting. I know that doesn't mean that you're going to fight, and it doesn't mean that you're going to do an awful lot of really cool smashing things. It just means that you do it with panache and magic. But anyway, enough of me rambling. Thank you if you're watching this on the YouTube channel. Thank you so much if you're listening to this in the podcast, because this is going to be both. Leave us your comments and get in touch with us. Please join us in our Facebook page, which I would love to have you there, or in Twitter, where I am at GMS Magazine. And I very, very much look forward to hearing your comments. I'll see you at the end of the interview. Andrew, welcome to the show. First time for you to be here. Welcome. Come on in. Make yourself comfortable.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here. Thank you, Paco.
It's a pleasure. I am I'm actually, believe it or not, quite excited to have you around, because I saw your Kickstarter a little while ago, and now you are on Game On Tabletop, which is very exciting for me because they're very good friends and they're the people that I've partnered to do these kind of interviews, which means that I can kill two birds with one stone, which is to speak very highly of you and your game and speak very highly of Game On Tabletop, which is fantastic.
I also speak very highly of Game On Tabletop. I think they're great, and I think more publishers need to know about them.
Absolutely, yes. But since I don't know your happy self, I don't know how good you are answering questions. So we must make sure that you can give me responses when I ask questions. So I'm going to start with five questions to see, you know, just to get us in the swing of interviewing things.
Yeah.
So, question number one, tea or coffee?
Coffee for me, thank you.
Okay, that would be absolutely fine. I have a coffee machine. The beach or the mountain?
Oh, that is a difficult question because I like them both, but I'll settle on the beach. Okay. I do like to swim. I do like to sail, and I like it warm weather. So the beach sounds good.
Okay, so we were born in the same place. That's right. Okay, now question number three. Cars or motorbikes?
Well, I've never ridden a motorbike. I wanted to, and my mother stopped me because of the safety concerns that she had when my mother had a lot to say about what I could do. So I never picked it up. So I use cars, but still sometimes I dream of motorbikes.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough.
So I gave you both answers, but I drive cars.
Okay, fair enough. I'm kind of the same, except I wasn't because of my mom saying, no, you can't. But because in Spain, people drive like animals, and it's really dangerous.
So yeah, I live in Boston now, so I know what it's like. I don't know exactly what it's like in Spain, but I know what you mean when you say people drive like animals.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. Okay, now we're getting onto the serious questions. Question number four. Fantasy or science fiction?
Fantasy. I like them, again, I like them both, but fantasy has always captivated me more. And I'm trying to think about why. I mean, I started playing Dungeons and Dragons when I was about 8 years old. So that was an early influence. And I just like magic. And, I was fascinated with knights and armor and dragons and all of that. So if I had to choose, I would choose fantasy.
Okay, good. Fantasy it is. Okay, last but not least, zombies or vampires?
Well, that really depends. What do you mean? Am I more afraid of? I think I would go with vampires because everyone else is doing zombies right now. And I think that the zombie market is kind of saturated. So if I were to write fiction, to make a game, to create a story, I would pick vampires because there's so much zombie on the market now. And that's the spin I'll take on your question.
Okay, good, good. That makes perfect sense. Okay, so now we have established that you can indeed answer questions, answer them quickly and rather well. I can start asking you about Magonomia.
Yes.
Because you have written a lot of words for this game. This is huge, man.
It is too big. If I were to do it again, I would make two books. I'd make it in two volumes. And one would be the mechanics and the magic, and the other would be the setting. That's not how I started. That's not how I organized my crowdfunding. That's not what I promised to backers. So they're getting everything in one book. Okay. It's big. Now, part of the reason it's so big is that it's a fate-based system. And I had very strong feedback early from playtesters that they wanted everything contained in one book. They wanted everything they needed to play contained in one book, meaning they didn't want to be referring to a separate fate rule book. Now, Fate is licensed under the Open Game License, so they're very gracious, Evil Hat, to share their content. So I reprinted and ended up rewriting the entire Fate rule book, or almost the entire Fate rule book that's included in there. So that's one of the reasons why it's so big.
Okay, tell me a little bit though about the setting, because it's a game that you can play mages.
Everybody plays a wizard.
Yeah.
Yes. So this comes from a very long love that I had for Ars Magica. I don't know if you've played Ars Magica. It's a historical fantasy game about wizards. Mm-hmm. And when I remember when I first picked up Ars Magica, when my friend bought it for me as a gift when we graduated high school, I thought, oh, this is exciting. This will be about the Italian Renaissance and the magic there. But it wasn't. It was set in an earlier period. And that idea of what would wizards in the Renaissance be like stayed with me for 30 years. we decided to explore it. Some other Ars Magica authors and I were having discussions about what happens after the fifth edition ends. And we started imagining what it would be like to do, you know, what if they had made different choices? Mm-hmm. And that led us to a different game, right? It led us to to realize that there would be a different game. If you choose a Renaissance setting, it would be a different game from Ars Magica, which has a medieval setting. And I like the Renaissance period because it was a time, there was a period until about 1600 or 1575-ish, where magic was taken seriously, and there was no difference between what today we call magic and science. Mm-hmm. It was emerging, but and that was just a fascinating idea that magic was taken seriously in Europe at a time that's documented that we can read about. Mm-hmm. So that's the setting. And then why England, it was very easy for me. I'm writing for an English speaking audience. I'm more familiar with English history, and everyone in English speaking countries has to learn about Shakespeare in school. So they have some familiarity with the period and with the dialect of the time in England. Mm-hmm. And then when you look at the history of Queen Elizabeth's reign is just a fascinating time for England. And there's a wealth of storytelling possibilities there. So there was a logical progression of thought that led us into this historical fantasy setting. Got stronger.
Sounds like you're a bit of a history buff.
I've always enjoyed historical themed games, which is funny because you asked me science fiction or fantasy, right? And I said fantasy. historical fantasy. Okay. I am a bit of a history buff. My first historically themed game was Call of Cthulhu that mm-hmm. I played. And then shortly afterward, Ars Magica. And I just got fascinated with European history, not so much what they taught us in school, but when I started researching for Ars Magica, what was happening in southern France. And England actually ruled a portion of southern France at the time. And I was, wow, I had no idea. This is this is amazing. And it went from there.
So. I'm familiar with about what kind of mages can we play?
Yeah, we have five different kinds of magic that we call magical sciences. Mm-hmm. Three of them are based on the Hermetic intellectual tradition of magic. Oh, you have a cat. I have a cat.
and they come at the same time. That's
they
awesome.
They do. So there's alchemy. There's astrology. There's theurgy, which is it's a kind of spirit magic. It's a kind of spirit magic derived from commanding spirits from authority, from learning, being granted power over spirits in some way or earning it. And then there are two that are based on other periods of history because we wanted to broaden options. So there's sorcery, which is, it started out as dark magic, but actually it's just fine. it's another kind of spirit magic that's based on bargains with spirits. And then there's witchcraft, which is the folk magic of Europe. And in England, witchcraft has a very particular and well-preserved body of lore.
Mm-hmm, true. So is the magic spells and the magic kind of approaches that are featured in the game based on real, in brackets, real magic?
Yeah. Yes. As a matter of fact, it is. That was one of the questions we were entertaining, is what would happen if magic were more like the historical sources? Mm-hmm. And it turns out it's very playable. In fact, it's much closer to the historical sources than I thought it would be when we started 4 years ago developing the game. I thought we'd have some historical flavor, but when I found ever there was sort of a logical consistency problem, in the magic system, I'd go and I'd read the historical sources, and they hold up. And it shouldn't be surprising because smart people in mm-hmm. Europe took it seriously. So there's a lot of logical consistency there. And we there's a theory behind it. And we went with that. And that gives us, I mean, for someone like me who plays a lot of games, it's intellectually satisfying. Mm-hmm. But also for people who are more hobbyists and are playing for fun, right? Mm-hmm. It gives just a depth of flavor that you can't get from, well, maybe the most brilliant authors can invent it, but unless, you know, someone like Tolkien probably can, it's just like a historical setting is richer and deeper. Historically themed magic is richer and deeper. We did make some changes to how magic works to make it playable, to make it appealing to a modern audience. But every time I had a design problem to solve, going closer to the Renaissance sources actually was my solution.
How does magic play, actually? What's mechanically like?
Mechanically, magic is the wizards have a repertoire of spells, and every spell is rather it does a specific thing, but that thing is useful. Okay. We have several kinds of invisibility. That's a simple example. There are several different invisibility spells, and turning invisible is useful. So you'll have a repertoire of spells that will do specific things, and they're organized by degree, where the first degree spell is the weakest spell that is likely to be useful. Mm-hmm. And the fourth degree is the highest that beginning wizards can have.
Okay.
There's a fifth degree and a sixth degree that you can aspire to. And the seventh degree is unattainable. It's the legendary elixir of eternal life or something like that.
Right.
Now, so how does magic play? You'll have spells, and most spells take some preparation time. They take 10 minutes or so to cast, and I would say that the science of sorcery and witchcraft have the most spells that can be cast very quickly. Mm-hmm. So most spells have to be cast outside of a combat or emergency situation. They have to be cast to prepare. With some exceptions. The spell, now, unlike, say, a very well-known leading fifth edition fantasy game, mm-hmm. There's not a limitation of how many spells you can cast in a day.
Okay.
So you can cast your spells whenever you like, mm-hmm. as a wizard, whenever it fits the situation. We're using the Fate Core system. So what I like about that is that when you roll your dice to cast the spell, if your dice fall short, that's not necessarily a simple failure. It can be success at a cost.
Okay.
And that ties in so well with historically themed magic because, for example, if you're casting a spell to ask a spirit to do divination for you and to get information, and you succeed at a cost, you can make it interesting where the information is useful, but it's misleading.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they tell you that you'll find the person that you want to meet at a tavern at night. But they don't tell you that you're also likely to get your purse stolen if you go there. That's an example, and it's an opportunity for improvisation. Failure in Fate is an opportunity for improvisation. So when spells fail, they get complicated in interesting ways, and the player actually has a voice in how that happens. So it's much less frustrating. A big thing in about magic that I want to talk about is divination, because I was very influenced by Robin Laws and Trail of Cthulhu, where he said, the mystery in Trail of Cthulhu is not about finding clues. It's about interpreting the clues, right? And that's the fun of the mystery. And I realized that divination is not about trying to find facts. It's about trying to find meaning. And that's the way divination spells are written. The game master has control over what divination spells reveal. They don't reveal facts. They reveal what you need to know, which is very different. It's narrative. And so this, we can have divination, which is a big theme in historical magic, but it's the information is always under the game master's control. So they can always feed it in, you know, directly if that's what you need based on how the game is going. If the players are frustrated, you just tell them, go here and it'll get things moving again. And if they want, you can give them puzzles if they want a puzzle. It's very powerful. So that's part of how magic works. Magic is subtle compared to, you know, I was going to say compared to mainstream fantasy like The Lord of the Rings, but actually, if you look at The Lord of the Rings,
it's quite subtle. There isn't that much magic in there, is there?
It's like that, you know?
I mean, the whole place is magical, but you don't see many people casting fireballs and, you know, flying around and doing all sorts of funky stuff.
That's, Maganumi is like that. I mean, we some of the more bold spells that we have are turning invisible, flying on a broomstick, and levitation. Those are the most overt ones that I can think of, but there are a lot of them that, like astrology, that just, give you, well, there's an example, and I don't remember the name of it, but there's a defensive spell where, it just makes attacks miss you, and it seems to be luck, but it's because of the stars. It's because because you are using the power of Mars to divert the attacks of your enemies. But when what it looks like is they just miss.
Okay.
That's but actually
pretty cool.
Yeah.
That sounds very, very cool. Tell me a little bit about what is the setting like? Because you mentioned about, you know, England in the Victorian times. What have you done to it to make it palatable? Because England, Victorian times, was kind of a shitty place.
Well, this is Elizabethan times, but so it's the 1558 to 1603.
That was still a shitty place.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Okay. No, this is great. Thank you for asking this question, because especially I think throughout the world, but in the U.S., you know, there's talk about social justice now, and there's awareness, right, of just a lot of biases. And I did some soul searching in June about my position in you know, as a business owner and social justice. And this is related to your question, because what I came up with is that we control what stories we want to tell and what we include in the stories. The setting doesn't force unpleasantness on us. All right. Although, for example, there was a great deal of poverty and misery in England at the time. That doesn't mean you have to confront it in your game. You can choose that. And it was firm in my mind that I'm writing for a modern audience. We're not trying to hide what a shitty place historical England could be. But we're saying that you don't have to inflict that on the players. You don't have to make them uncomfortable. And you actually can talk about how you want to confront and what parts of the real world you want to confront in the game. I'll give you an example. There was a company in England. This is a real thing called the Company of Merchant Adventurers. and they organized trading expeditions to Russia and to other interesting places like Spain. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you're inspired by this and you want your wizard to join the company of merchant adventurers. Well, historically, they would probably only take men, right?
Okay.
And that's a thing where, you know, I recommend some dramatic license for players to say, well, sure, everybody in the company of merchant adventurers is men, but they've never had a woman apply. Right. Okay. And so they don't have to, we don't have to, historical people would be hostile, right, to the idea of a woman trying to join this. But why would we have to play that in our story, in our game, in our fantasy?
I'm definitely with you, because I've never understood people's need to maintain certain aspects of history whilst casting fireballs and flying on brooms, you know. It's
exactly.
It's a little bit, you're cherry picking here, and I wonder why that truly is.
So we write some words about that in the game. And this is part of why it's so big, right? it's not a lot of words about that. Well, another thing that I'll mention is representation of people, because we have the impression that only white men mattered in England at the time. Well, except, you know, there's a woman who's pretty important, right? The queen. and then, as it turns out, the second wealthiest person in England at the time was also a woman. And one of my colleagues, Timothy Ferguson, has just done this wonderful job of finding people with disabilities who were prominent and mm-hmm. held important offices. It's just that historians who wrote books in the 19th century didn't mention these things or didn't dwell on them. They didn't talk about, oh, well, here's someone who's openly gay and mm-hmm. was, you know, and was fine. But if you look in the history, you can find that. So I don't want people to think that it's an oppressive environment, right? Because first, I'm not convinced that history was as much homogeneous as mm-hmm. as we think. As we've been led to believe by books that were all written by men of a certain social class in a particular country in a narrow period of time, right? Our history books are heavily influenced by, you know, a certain kind of person, right? And that's changing now as we have more voices coming and writing in history. So I think that there's more diversity than a shallow reading of history would lead you to believe. And I also think that we control, even in a historical setting, we control what stories we have, what themes we talk about.
That sounds, it makes perfect sense to me, because I am a massive advocate of give people the choice, but, you know, don't necessarily restrict this because we've been told to do so. If you're going to keep historical accuracy, why do we always insist in keeping the unpleasant, nasty, bigoted things instead of getting the truly rough things about history, like, you know, the lack of hygiene and the lack of money and the lack of proper diet and the lack of proper due process to resolve real injustice? No, we take the, there were no women and there were no gay people and there were no people of color in there. WTF, you only have to scratch the surface to find out that's just not true. It's just not true. So get on with things. So how harsh is it to play adventures in your game? In the sense of, is it a world with difficult resources to obtain, with an awful lot of difficulties to get to the top of, you know, if you need to solve a murder to be able to talk to the person and find the right evidence? Is it very politically orientated? What is the world like?
The world is, I never had a clear answer. I want it to be both. You can play it as a very fairy tale fantasy. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare wrote a lot about fairies, and his contemporaries did as well. And you can also lean into the intrigue of the period. There were 19 documented assassination plots against Queen Elizabeth.
And she sorted out and survived it.
Booyah. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Respect.
Yes. And her, actually, it was in her reign that sort of the first modern intelligence service was organized. Mm-hmm. In the stories that I create and run, usually the wizards are heroes who are working, and I'm portraying the queen as good. This is another thing about history. When you have real people as characters in your game, you can play them as either heroes or as villains, depending on what parts of their personality and what parts of their actions do you want to highlight. Okay. When I run the game, and this is going to come through, right? This is what I think other people will pick up on. Elizabeth is a good queen who's trying to hold the realm together, and there are bad forces trying to take her down, and those bad forces are using magic, possibly dark magic, to attack and threaten her. And you, as wizards, are are working to thwart the supernatural threats against the realm. Okay. So that's a way to play it, that blends magic with intrigue. If you're just working against regular spies, you're going to crush them with your magical divination. You'll solve their mysteries like that. You can also play it though as a fairy tale, or as a straight more, small scale adventure, where you may be saving, instead of the queen, you may be saving your village, or you may be wizards for hire. Mm-hmm. There were a great many sort of campaign frames. Mm-hmm. I'm borrowing from Robin Law's Trail of Cthulhu again, campaign frames that we discussed, and we had about a dozen, and they're all viable. We can't put them all in the core book, but Elizabethan Ghostbusters was one one theme that I really like. I'll stop. That should give you, I think, that's an answer.
No, that's pretty good. But also it leads me very nicely to the next question that I wanted to ask, which is about the development of the game for the future, because it seems, being in Elizabethan times, it feels like there is plenty of opportunity for international intrigue, for international, you said, assassinations, attempts, invasions, new markets, new trade routes, new exploration to different continents, to new countries.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot that you could do. What's in your mind?
There's an awful lot in my mind. I mean, in the near term, what we want to do is to develop even the city of London more as an adventure setting. So I can imagine a book about London. I'm not committed to that yet, but I can imagine it. Because there's just so much lore, and a lot of it stems from that period. I would say I would have to discuss with my co-authors what they want to develop and explore next. But the Italian Renaissance and to take the same magic and transport it into Italy, to Northern Italy, or whatever part of Italy you want to play in. But, you know, at the time, Italy was several countries, right?
Well, yeah, but you know what? I think if you are going to go into Italy, somehow there must be some sort of art magic.
Yeah.
That would be unbelievable. You know, magic that's performed through art. That would be incredible.
See, there's an idea.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anytime. That's anytime. Tell me about, a little bit about combat, because I know that there's an awful lot of people who lie, you know, high-fueled, you know, high-octane combat. How does combat work for magic? Because you were mentioning earlier about, you know, having a few minutes to cast a spell, some spells being quicker than others. So I can't imagine that this is the sort of thing where can you just cast a fireball or a ray of lightning or something like that?
No fireballs, although lightning, actually, yeah, we do have call down lightning from the sky as a, I think, fifth degree spell, which is shockingly low. Yeah. What combat usually is you use spells to buff yourself or your allies before the fight, and you can use hexes and curses during the fight. So suddenly, I've had quite a number of people curse their combat opponents with violent stomach distress during battle, and that gets the job done.
Hello.
You know, you mentioned zombies and vampires earlier. If you want to go that way, then I would say alchemy and theurgy would be your go-to sciences because they both have good combat buffing spells. Okay. And alchemy would be more on the defense of strengthening your armor, and theurgy would be more strengthening your attacks. So that would make a really good tag team. We have exorcism in the game, so you can attack spirits using exorcism. There's a lot to be said for just stabbing your opponent with a sword, because this is a game where everybody's meant to be a wizard. So there's no reason to prevent wizards from having combat skills.
Okay, fair enough.
If you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Right? What I find, though, is that players generally don't take the bait when I offer them a fight. You know, when I'm playing, there's something about playing in a world that they can imagine that feels like the real world, that inhibits them a little bit, makes them think about finding ways other than overt violence to solve their problems, and using magic to escape or outwit their attackers is very common. And I'm fine with that. I was expecting more stand-up fights against werewolves and the like. But if the players want to use their magic to sneak around the bandits and come up behind them and sap them on the head, more power to them. Yeah. People like to use their magic creatively. So we've got some combat spells, it's a fairly combat light game in my experience.
Okay, that's fair enough indeed. Okay, the game, you founded it in Kickstarter, and it's now, as we were mentioning at the beginning of the interview, in game on tabletop.
Yes.
Why did you decide to go both platforms? Because you did well in Kickstarter, didn't you?
I did not meet the goal.
Okay.
It did not fund in Kickstarter, so I canceled the campaign. When it was not on track to fund. I'm a first-time publisher, and this is why the book is so big. So I set a really high funding goal because I needed to finance the print run. So I didn't hit it. And then, quite honestly, it was when the union dispute arose at Kickstarter. I shopped around.
Right.
I wouldn't have looked beyond Kickstarter if it hadn't been for that, but I did. and I found Game on Tabletop, and I got really excited about Game on Tabletop. I got excited about it because it's all games.
Yes.
And then I looked a little further and I saw that they had a partnership with Drive-Thru for fulfillment and distribution. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, well, this solves a problem for me. And then I contacted Game on Tabletop and an account manager contacted me. And, you know, ever since then, they've been treating me like I'm a big name publisher. I feel they've been really great in supporting and advising me. I have to do all the work, but they can tell me what work to do. They can advise me on that, on some of it at least. So I really feel that they're a partner, and I'm incredibly loyal to Game on Tabletop now. And we did hit the goal. So Maganomia is funded. Yes. We're now accepting late pledges, and I'm working on finishing the manuscript, which wasn't as far along as I thought it was. Okay. It's big. And the artwork. And that's what's happening now. We're about 2/3 of the way through artwork. So I think Game on Tabletop has a big future because they're specialized for games, and what they can do, that kinds of help they can give you is more than what I got from Kickstarter.
Oh, definitely. They are on the, they are really on the ball on what you can do. I mean, what I'm seeing, which is the reason why I remember seeing the campaign in Kickstarter. And that's why I thought that you had already done well in there, because the book is completely fully funded, but you're making the campaign last way longer than it would normally do in Kickstarter. It seems like you have divided this campaign into, this is the amount of time and money it takes for us to fund the game itself, and anything else is a bonus, is a pre-order for people who didn't get to the campaign on time.
That's exactly what I'm doing. And we can reach stretch goals, mm-hmm. or level up goals, as they're called in Game on Tabletop, through there. So the deadline for that, for the late backers, is just the latest that I think I could do to add more art.
Okay.
Okay. So, you know, gamers love color art, and it's one of the big expenses.
It's one that an awful lot of publishers don't fully take into account when they start budgeting for games, which is, it can come and bite you in the ass very, very easily and very quickly. So before we finish, tell me a little bit about what kind of pledge levels can people find and what kind of prices are we talking about?
Well, I didn't get very rich and fancy with the prizes and the pledge levels. I had to keep it simple, partly because I don't have a catalog of products to offer as bonus rewards and the like. So we have the standard level is $25, which is, it gets you a PDF of the illustrated finished game. It gets you immediate access to the work in progress, the early access manuscript, so that you have something to play. And also to show that there really is a game here. Okay.
And I have to say, there is. After taking a look at that manuscript, and it exists, and it's 396 pages full of beautiful words. So it's a real thing.
Thank you. And I do feel I need to prove that because I'm a first-time publisher. We have a $15 pledge level for people who want to support us and are experiencing some hardship or uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Same rewards. You get your name listed. It doesn't say whether you paid the higher or the lower amount. So we just inviting people who are excited about the game to try to contribute. Even we'll take $1 pledges, and $1 will get you the early access.
Okay.
So you can play.
That's actually a very good value for money, I have to say.
Thank you. At $75, we have gaming group bundle. So you get four copies for the price of three. These are all PDF rewards. Okay. For hard copy fulfillment, I'm relying on DriveThruRPG, and I'll give you a print-on-demand coupon to print the book at cost.
That's very wise.
That solves a big problem for me. Yeah. It's why my Kickstarter goal was so high. And then we have a premium level, $200. We had more takers than I expected, where you get to choose one of our pieces of original artwork, and you get an exclusive print.
That's actually pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
So that was my best idea for a premium reward level. If I were doing it again, I probably would have, as some people do, you know, have the creator run a game session for you. I'd probably do that. I'm doing it for free instead.
That's not bad at all. The campaign still has quite a while to go, 196 days at the time of recording the interview. When do you think the people will be able to have the books in their shelves?
May 31st is my target date, May 31st of 2021. Okay. I'm new in the gaming business, but I'm an experienced project manager for my day job.
Okay.
And we did have to make some adjustments due to inexperience primarily, and there's a COVID-19 impacts, but mostly it's that making a role-playing game is a big job that's hard.
Yes.
As a publisher,
I can attest to that.
I'm on track for the May 31st delivery, and this is for a project manager. This is easy to do. I give you monthly updates when I'm on track, and weekly updates when I'm not. So you'll know. Yeah, I'm communicating. But that's when you can expect to get it. Is good. The end of May. We've got the level up goals add premium content. Just they add it to the core. Well, not always to the core book, because there's the adventure. Our first goal is make another adventure that would be a backer. I'm not going to say a backer exclusive, but it'll be free to backers.
Okay.
And we can probably deliver that to you well before May. And then the next level is adding more artwork. And then we just expand, more adventures, more artwork. And that's how the level up goals will go.
That sounds pretty good. Well, I'm quite excited. I'm looking forward to seeing how this is going to look like at the end, because it sounds like it's going to be a mighty tome. It's going to be a lot of pages in there.
Yeah, my challenge is to keep it to an affordable print-on-demand price.
Okay. I get the feeling you'll manage to do that.
Thanks.
Okay. Right. Okay. So let's wrap this up. And just to, you know, to go into a bit of a more zen kind of mode and chill, I have last three questions for you. The first question is, what's the best advice that no one has ever given you?
Wow. I mean, there's advice that's really good that I've heard lately. best advice that no one has ever given me. I don't think anyone has ever been able to express to me how important it is. I've always been told, you know, think positive and speak positively, but never the why.
Okay.
Never in a way that stuck. I guess eventually it did, but how important it is to show people that they matter. And I mean everyone. I mean new friends like you. I think it's sound advice, and it's very ancient advice, all the way back, all right, to early Buddhism. But it's so hard, the advice how to do it. Mm-hmm. That's what I never got, and I can't put it in words. I encourage you to just, anyone who may be listening to this, to just try. And, you know, when your mother said, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything, mm-hmm. that doesn't mean you must only say nice things. It means you must always say a nice thing. Mm-hmm. In addition to any criticism that you want to give, or any objection that you want to raise, you always have to say something nice along with it.
That makes sense. That's a beautiful thing. Okay. Question number two. What's the best mistake that you would like to make again?
I'm trying to think, because I learn a lot from mistakes. I'm a bit stumped. I'm thinking of things that didn't go as planned, but then what would I want to do again? Best mistake that I would want to make again. I imagine that people have to ponder this one for a bit.
it's a very tough question, I have to say. It's very hard.
There have been many mistakes that have turned out well, but right.
That's a difficult one, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. A real simple one is, I made, I've done some cooking, I'm not a hobbyist, but in the kitchen, and this is a very shallow answer to a deep question, right?
But, any answer is good answer.
You know, I made beef stew one time, mm-hmm. and I marinated the beef because I bought really cheap beef. I was in college. It was a long time ago. And I made a mistake, and I used way too much vinegar in the mm-hmm. marinade, and the whole stew had wine vinegar cooked through it, but it was amazing. I would like to do that again. And I tried to do it on purpose, and I couldn't. So that's what I got.
that's a very decent one. I can understand that being delicious and amazing, because vinegar would tenderize the meat quite a lot, and the acidity would make it very tasty.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can see that. That's a very good one. Now I need to try that in my kitchen. Okay. last but not least, imagine that you have a time machine, and you go back in time, and you meet your 10-year-old self, and you say to your 10-year-old self, "Do not do this." What is this?
Well, don't think that you're better than other people just because you're smart. but I would, 10-year-old me wouldn't listen to that. I know what I would say. Do not do. I would say, don't let people, don't be afraid. Don't stop yourself from playing sports.
Okay.
That's what I would say.
That's a very decent, very good one indeed. Andrew, thank you so much for being with me today. It's really exciting to see the project coming to life, and seeing a game where you can just play, mages, just wizard. This should be really, really good fun. So I very much look forward to seeing the project being fulfilled and looking glorious.
Thank you so much. This was really fun. It was a great pleasure to meet you, Parker. I hope to speak to you again sometime.
You bet you shall, sir. You will indeed. Very, very soon, I hope.
Great.
And that is it. There is still a little bit of time at the time of publishing this episode to back this project. Please, please take a look. I think it's going to be very well worth it. And it has already been funded. So the game is going to come out. The only thing that can happen with your help is that it's going to be even better, which would be absolutely fantastic. So, without further ado, thank you so much for being there. It is truly and genuinely appreciated. And until the next time, I will talk to you very, very soon. Take care.